Yeah. Happy New Year, huh? Okay. This is for the 8:30 service. I want to welcome our video venue crowd that's going to be here. And I'm glad you're here today. And if you get your notes out, there's kind of a trivia question to start with. And it's the phrase, just win, baby. And I'm asking the video venue crowd and also 8:30. Does anyone know who made that phrase? Al Davis. Okay, Al Davis made that phrase popular. It was a motto he came up with for the Oakland Raiders. He is the youngest head coach and general manager at the age of 33. And for a great part of his career, had tremendous success, and he just kind of sauntered around, and he would just, you can see YouTube snatches of this where he just kind of, you know, baits the crowd, and he says, just win, baby, with his kind of, you know, Massachusetts, Brooklyn kind of accent, and the crowd would just go crazy with that. And then, you know, ironically, toward the end of his career, he set another NFL record for the most consecutive years in a row, I think seven, of an NFL team that have lost at least 11 games or more in a season. And so it's just kind of ironic how all of that goes together. And part of what that motto has done for us in our culture is it resonated, from him. He just brought up something that was already there. Because there's a lot of wisdom phrases, there's a lot of catchphrases that you can find. And a lot of times in books, whether they're business books or whatever, they kind of have these watermark areas, these little gray boxes where they emphasize a certain phrase or a certain slogan, and you can live your whole life just kind of spewing out these different slogans or different phrases of wisdom. And you know, sometimes they're valid and sometimes they're not. And one of them is you just need to learn how to win in life. And so we're going to look a little bit today on this idea of how to be a winner in 2012 and what that really, really means. Because what would God mean using this phrase? What would God mean if you were in prayer and somehow you had a mystical experience, maybe not with a Brooklyn accent, but and all of a sudden you hear this from God that says, just win, baby. What do you think God would be meaning when he says something like that to you? Just win, baby. Because kind of what we mean in our culture is whatever you can get away with, whoever you have to walk over, whatever you need to do, there is a crystal clear, there is a golden mean definition of what it means to be a winner, what it means to conquer, what it means to be number one. And whatever it takes to be that is what is most important, and that's part of our culture. But what does God mean by this? I was on YouTube, and there's one guy I like to listen to sometimes. His name's Bill Butterworth, and he just has some great stories, and he has some great insights, and so I pulled some information for him. One is a story that it's a personal friend of his, and this guy was a decathlon runner, and he was one of the top-rated guys. The problem was, there are politics involved, and he was one of the top guys in 1980. And that was, the Olympics, we canceled the Olympics. I think that was 1980. And he was one of the top guys there. So the year that he should have really been at his peak and competed, he couldn't do that. So the next Olympics came around, 1984. And by then, he was getting a little bit older. In fact, they called him the granddad of the decathlon. And he was competing in this, and he's actually doing pretty well. And he was I don't know what you call the discus or the shot put, one of those type things. But when this guy competes, he just always went all out. And so he was spinning around, and then he shot the shot put there. But then he made a foul. What does that mean when you step outside of this little circle? Because you have to stay inside this little circle when you push this thing. And it was one of his longest shot puts ever. And then this coach said, look, you can move ahead and stay in the pack if you just ease off a little bit. But this guy wasn't that type of guy. And he just went all for it again and shot it further than he'd ever shot it before. But he barely stepped out of the line. And therefore, because of that, he had virtually no chance of winning or placing in this. And so one of the last things left to do was this 1,500 meters, this really grueling race. It's at a race length where it's not, you can't pace yourself as if it's long distance. It's almost like the longest sprint ever. It's just that type of race. It's just so grueling. And he was so distraught that he just walked out of the L.A. Coliseum and found his wife and said, honey, we're just going to go home. And they were driving home down the freeway. It's in the afternoon, and he got close to, I think, where the guy lived, Knott's Boulevard, where Knott's Berry Farm is area. And that was his turnoff, and he looked at his wife, and he just says, honey, I've been thinking about it. I'm going to have to go home and look at my two little boys, and I don't want them to think for the rest of their life that their dad got discouraged and quit. We're going back. And so in that freeway traffic, this guy turns around, and the way my colleague Bill Butterworth said, there was actually in those days there was a gap in the guardrail, and he made a U-turn on the freeway. So there you go. And so he made his way all the way back to the Coliseum, and he got there because he had to sprint from the parking lot all the way in there. And he got there just a few minutes before the event was going to start, and the officials got together and to figure out what the rules said on this. And what they figured out, there was no rule about someone getting discouraged, walking out, driving home, changing their mind, you know, doing a U-turn on the freeway and coming back and being in the race. So they let the guy be in the race. The problem is, this guy, I don't know if you've ever competed before, but you build an adrenaline up. And that I've been on teams before where our adrenaline was sky high before a football game, and we did great for the first quarter and a half. But then the adrenaline would drop off, and then we just got killed, you know, in the game. Well, this guy's adrenaline was shot. His energy is shot because he had sprinted all the way back into the stadium, so he wasn't in any shape at all to compete in this race. And sure enough, there are 33 competitors, and as the race went on, he was in the 33rd place in this race. And it got so bad that as the race coming to an end, someone had almost lapped him, but he just kept running. And you know, this is Hollywood, right? This is L.A. here. And I don't know if you remember a popular movie at this time. It was Chariots of Fire. And some guy got inspired by this, and he knew someone in the announcement booth area. And he had, back in those days, they had what were called cassette tapes. Any of you remember cassette tapes, okay? he brought a cassette tape in with that Chariots of Fire song. And so while this guy is just stumbling along in 33rd place just to finish the race for his boys, that song starts to play in the stadium. And the people see this guy staggering and struggling to do the best he can. And then he finally crosses the line with the music, da 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 da, playing everything. And you know what? At the end of the race, the reporters swarmed the finish line, and they ran right by the first, second, and third time finishers, and they went directly to this guy who finished 33rd out of 33 racers. And the reason I tell you this story is because someone really not famous while he lived on earth, but whose words we still remember today, fascinatingly, said this: the first shall be last, but the last shall be what? Do you remember? The last shall be first. And that's a foundational thought for us today on January 1st, 2012. And I know I'm speaking to the 11:30 crowd also, but I just want to get this on record. For those of you here at 8:30 on New Year's Day morning, you are the saints of the church. I just want to let you know that. So just look around. I know some of you came in with sunglasses, you know, and I had to tell you the music won't be too loud today. No, I'm just kidding. But we're going to look just a little bit at that this whole idea of this guy here, you know what he was? He was faithful. He was faithful to finish the race. And the most important thing in finishing the race wasn't just to disappoint or not disappoint himself, but also those around him that were watching his life. That's what brought him back. And I don't know what 2011 was like for you, and some of you might have felt like quitting this year. Remember this, God is looking at you, but there are others looking at you too. And the best place to start to build character and credibility in your life, if you're young, is before, if God blesses you with little ones, before they even get into this world. Already be working on your character. Already be working on these things, because God does want you to be a winner. And so let's look at some of this now. And you have a very simple outline because it's filled out for you. Except I'm going to change one of the words here. And we'll get to that in just a minute. So let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 4, because I think this is a great chapter to help define what it really means to be a winner in this life. 1 Corinthians is a letter about how to be godly in an ungodly world, because Corinth, if you know anything about the ancient history of Corinth, I have described it this way. It is like the seediest part of L.A. on steroids. It was just really, really, really bad. And so I remember being in a Sunday school class back when I was in graduate school, and there was a young lady there that my wife and I got to know. And I remember her dad, who had a ministry in inner city Washington, D.C., very, very tough neighborhood. And he talked a lot about, you know, just how gritty the ministry was. And but she had a very different opinion about it. She said, all I know is I never want to live there again, because every morning when I'd go to school, I'd be propositioned for sex and I'd be offered drugs every single day. And it got really scary, okay? This is what it was like in Corinth. When people would be coming to a worship service, they'd have to navigate their way through all kinds of things. And so he talked about how to be godly in a very ungodly world. He also talked about there was a lot of bickering about people had their own personal agendas about what they thought church should be like, and they'd get their nose bent out of shape over little things. And he tried to expand their whole idea of what it means to really be the church. And it's for about so many others out there that have never heard about this. And he talked about the power of the gospel. In fact, he finishes in 1 Corinthians 15:10, he says, by the grace of God, I am what I am. And he remembered who he used to be. And this is what we need to remember as we're looking at the year 2012 now, and maybe the year 2011. And maybe you've blown it, maybe you've disappointed, and maybe you've relapsed in some way. You have to remember, any good quality in you, it's by the grace of God only. It's the power of the gospel of Christ. And this is what we teach, this is what we declare at New Life. We do this not in a triumphal way. We do this not in a belligerent way. We do this in a way that's respectful. And hopefully our lives show credibility. And we do so in an unhurried way and not trying to coerce people into decisions or things that they're not near ready to make. Does that make sense to you? Because our American culture is very impatient. It says, what's with you? I have shared the gospel with you 3 times and you have not responded yet. You're not my friend anymore. See, you can't do things like that, and we shouldn't. So, if you want to be a winner in God's eyes in 2012, you know, our culture says things so different. And we tend to have this kind of cultural clock ticking inside of us. It's like, you're a certain age, and it's like, have you achieved this yet by this age? Do you have this amount of wealth by this age? Are you, have you established this in your relational life and this in your financial life? And look, it's not wrong to have goals. In fact, only 3% of people write down any kind of goals. And we're going to give you an opportunity to do that later on today, because it's the people that actually write their goals down that have a much greater chance of achieving any kind of goals in their lives, okay? So you're going to get a chance to do that a little bit in the future. I want you to look. I'm reading this out of the New King James Version, chapter 4, 1 Corinthians. But before we do that, I want to show you a couple of pictures of a different idea of winter. And this was an unscheduled trip. I had taken a trip to Lagos, Nigeria, to teach some leadership. And before I went, I had discovered some things going on, what God was doing there. And so I think my son was with me on this, took an independent trip into a suburb north of Lagos called Ota. I think it was just a small bedroom community of 1.5 million, okay? Because Lagos is like 24, 26 million people. And there is a guy there that had been raised in poverty and felt such a deep call that the gospel can absolutely change people's lives. But a part of the call to that was to help people understand what it meant to really succeed in life, and that this can include all areas of your life, and to help people come from the lowest poverty stratus and to elevate themselves, to improve themselves for the sake of the gospel, and to raise themselves to the higher positions of leadership, because in very, very poor countries, it is the people with wealth and the people with powerful leadership who have the greatest influence over other people. It's always been that way. If you're a missionary in the Philippines, you understand it's not wrong or evil to target the top leaders and the people with the most wealth, because when their testimony is given, it's just the way the cultures are in our secular cultures worldwide. What they say has much greater weight. You don't think that's true in America? When celebrities say certain things, you don't think that has an influence on a lot of our people? Sure it does. Well, God helped this guy start this church, and I want to show you a couple. Here's a picture of the outside of this building. Do you see this right here? Now, as we were driving to this place, we had a professional driver help us. You see some of the most dour and some of the and people in dire, rusted corrugated tin roofs, you know, just square mile after square mile, you know, just about this tall, and people have to stoop down to get in with dirt floors, and this is where people live. And where this is located, this actual plant is on a 70 acre plot, which is also on over a 10,000 acre area called Canaan Land that Winter's Chapel now has. And the most fascinating thing is they have to have giant fences with barbed wire on the top because of the level of crime in the area. But when you go through the front gate of Winter's Chapel, immediately you find something that you do not find in the whole area, and that is green grass. You don't see that anywhere in all of Lagos unless it's on a professional soccer field, because people just can't afford it and there's no infrastructure for that. And you'll see trees and you'll see lined air, all the stuff that we take it for granted here in the United States. There's even filling stations. They have Covenant University there. And when you go through those gates, it's not about the haves and the have-nots. It's they have created, and this pastor understood, and I'm not endorsing everything the guy teaches or everything in his doctrine. I'm sure there's some major changes. But he named this chapel what he did for a reason. And it was this. It says, God has an idea and an understanding what it means to really be a winner. And we want to be an example of that in one of the poorest cities. In fact, Lagos has been called the most corrupt, most poverty-stricken city in the world. And it's fascinating to me that this facility here is the largest church facility in the world also. Now, I want to show you a picture of the inside, too. And here's the inside, and just one service. And we had a young man named John, actually, Jonathan, give us a tour. And he gave us a story of his life a little bit. And there's just tens of thousands of stories like this. How can I say that? Because this church runs around 250,000 in this one location right here. And they have taken many, many of the poorest of the poor of the poor, and also people without any kind of hope, and even Christians who are the poorest of the poor of the poor, and not only built them up spiritually, but helped build their life skills, not unlike the people of Corinth. Helped build their life skills, helped teach them, look, this is how you can become a good leader. This is how you can prosper in your business, that you can turn around and help other people instead of just being humble and just doing this, please help me and my family, please help me and my family. And there's nothing wrong with that, and they're very, very generous. But they help take, and they have all these private schools and private universities, and they have done really what Wesley did in the 1700s in England, where he took the poorest of the poor people, the coal miners, and people who are so poor, and they were dressed so improperly, they were not allowed into the Anglican cathedrals. They were not even allowed to come in and worship. And so Wesley did something revolutionary. He went out into the fields and preached to them who were not allowed to come into the beautiful cathedrals. Now, who else taught outside? Do you remember? Somebody. You know? Yeah. And what happened is he took a whole generation of the poorest of the poor. And when their lives are being mended, it's fascinating, a book that will Marty and Charlotte Murphy, and we're going to talk about this next Sunday. They are, you know, he's on staff as our calling pastor, and they're doing a six-month assignment in South Africa, and they're going to be teaching life skills and things like this. It's fascinating that in one of the books, it talks about how to heal marriages. The first chapter is the man needs to really get his heart right with God. And the second chapter is the woman needs to really get her heart right with God. Okay? And so you have the story from the Wesleys, you have a story from Winter's Chapel, whatever. They start right where people are at, because many times, I'm not saying to be poor is just because you're a sinner. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is you can have a really rotten marriage in a tin hut with a dirt floor. You can have a really rotten marriage and be a multimillionaire, okay? You can have double poverty, you know, being poor or rich, okay? But you take people right where they're at with their most basic need, but you don't just deal with the one thing. That is, do you know whether you're going to heaven or not? That is not at all what the church has ever been about. It's about you're building disciples, you're building people, and disciples and leaders are one and the same thing, okay? So how can you be a winner in 2012? I'm giving you some wonderful stories here of how people have done incredible things, and Winter's Chapel has this reputation in a country that has a reputation that nothing can get done, nothing can be accomplished. It's a nightmare of infrastructure. And yet, not just Winter's Chapel, but other churches and church leaders, they're the ones that are really having an impact in social justice, in addressing poverty in the area, and dealing with a lot of these things. And this is what, you know, followers of Jesus should be and they should be about. So let me read 1 Corinthians 4, because your outline's done here. So your work is basically done. Because have you ever wondered what it really means to be a winner? It says this, let a man or woman so consider us as servants of Christ. Would you circle the word? Well, you don't have that in your notes. So, as servants of Christ and stewards. I use the King James because I like the word stewards. So your version might say faithful ones or something like that. That is a one word, and it's stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful. But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. And let's just stop right there. And if you really want to learn to be a winner, and by the way, you know, as we look at this, have you ever thought, have you ever had self-talk or something ever pop up? Have you ever heard language in your private thoughts sometimes? Listen, I'm just a loser. Have you ever heard that thought in your own thoughts sometime? Something ever come up like that, or you've thought that about someone else? You know, I'm just a loser. And I'm telling you, God has incredible clarity for every one of us here to understand what it really means to be a winner in the year 2012. And I want you to know that. And the first word here, themes for winning in God's eyes, is servant. Is servant. And don't write that down because it's already written down for you, okay? So, yeah, but it really means the idea of subordination. It's a healthy idea of authority. It's taking a view of serving other people. It's not posturing for power. It's not aggressive. And I know I've been in a lot of meetings like that. Even as a pastor, it's just amazing how pastors or any leaders can kind of posture. You get in a room and you kind of talk around and you kind of have these contests of who's who. And no matter what where you're at, you always have these measurement type things. And maybe this is more, you know, women can have different types of measurements. But the first major idea here is you have to understand is learning to really, really be a servant at the depth of your heart. This is key. Another one here we've looked at is steward then. And this is the idea of being found faithful. Are you a trustworthy person? You know, is your word really mean something? Being trustworthy, it's a manager. It's kind of like, when you see, you could kind of have an owner of a business, and he kind of might be sitting back and just, you know, sipping a Coke, and you have someone else running around taking care of everything, and that's the steward. That's the manager of the business. They're taking care. They're running everything. And the owner can actually be somewhere else. That's who we are. We have to understand we're not the owners. We are the stewards. We are the managers. When we understand that about our lives, our relationships, our possessions, all of this, we're stewards. We're stewards of this. And if we get in the back of our mind, unlike other people, we're self-made. We're more successful. We're more this and that. And you have to understand, God created you with a certain mind. God might have put you together relationally with other people to create some kind of a team or whatever, to where when you do stuff together, it just has done good things. But giving God the credit in all of this is so important. And then I want to use a different word than the word save here. I want to use the word see. So scratch out A-V-E and write in the word see. As I was looking at this today, I just feeling better about that. And that comes to verse 3 again. But with me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. Then it goes on to verse 4, for I know of nothing against myself, yet I am not justified by this. For he who judges me is who? And you don't know, because unless you read along with your Bible, it says, is the Lord. And then he goes on to say something I think is really important for us. Here it says, therefore, judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light, it's a warning, the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the heart. Then each one's praise will come from God. Part of pride is trying to keep a veneer of competence, of you can count on me, I'm the go person, and yet having this stuff, this darkness, that you just kind of want to skulk away and keep hidden and away. And when there's a real freedom, when we say what Paul says, by the grace of God, I am who I am. That is the beginning of winning. So who decides who's a winner? And what this passage seems to be saying is, do not pass judgment on people. God will God will reveal what is hidden in darkness sometime. Because what we can do, we can elevate certain people. And it's easy to do. And I'll tell you, at Winter's Chapel, I'm sure the bishop of this church is elevated by a lot of people. And this guy continues to understand, because I interviewed his top staff person, the bishop was out of town. And one of the key elements this guy continues to have is humility, because he understands he's riding a wave he did not make. He's just in a, you know, imagine surfing a wave that's 1,000 feet tall. Do you know how small your surfboard's going to look on that? It didn't start that way, but all of a sudden this wave's building and building and building. He knows he didn't, and he needs to keep focused to stay on top of the wave, because that would be one bummer of a wipeout, okay? And so we can tend to look at people differently. 1 Samuel 16, and the verse you can write in with that is verse 7. Verse 7 there. And this is the story of the replacement of a king. Saul had been the first king of Israel, and out of pride, God took him out of that position. So there was a selection for another leader. And it says, well, what had happened in the story, the guy named Samuel went to the house of Jesse, and he had all kinds of sons there. And Samuel examined each one of these sons, and he got impressed with a whole bunch of them. He goes, wow, look at these guys. You know, they just look kingly. They look kingly. Wow, do they fit the part. We could cast them in the movie of the next king. Look at those white teeth. Look at this, you know, countenance, and you know, look how tall this guy is, and how deep his voice is, and how masculine he sounds, and all this and that. And God kept saying, no, 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 no. And this is what it says in verse 7. But the Lord said to Samuel, listen, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. Not as a person, but in this position of leadership. The Lord, listen, the Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. If you want to be a winner in 2012, ask the Lord to give you insight to look past the flaws and the foibles and the inconsistencies and the incompetences and the stupidities when you are an eagle surrounded by turkeys. Okay? And just help the Lord to give you grace to understand that you have some turkishness in yourself. If you want to be a winner this year, you have to learn to do this. We look at all these different things, don't we? Okay. We can look in our culture at upper classes. Look, I'm not saying you have to, this idea we just want to hang with the beautiful. I'm not saying you have to be ugly for God, okay? I'm not saying that. Or that you have to look destitute. If you have nice clothes, wear them. You know, if you have a nice home, keep your home up. You know, it's not that. But God does look at the inside. And maybe 2011 was a difficult year for you. They actually did an article on that. International reporters just listed all of the things that have happened in 2011. They said, this has just been an amazingly wild year. All of the things and all the places they end up going. And maybe, you know, when this happens and things start to happen, and the bottom line is you start to realize it isn't what I drive. It isn't even where I live. What does matter is what God sees and what God sees inside of us, because it comes from the heart. You know, Paul kind of gives a list. If you go on in 1 Corinthians 4, and you might need to have your Bible open on some of this, he kind of gives a list, and I kind of identified 12 things about being a winner in God's eyes. Just let me read this. Paul says he's contrasting himself with other people who have different priorities. But Paul's basically saying, you know, I want to be a winner for God. And he says, we are fools for Christ, but you're wise for Christ. We are weak, but you're strong. We are, you are honored, but we are dishonored. this very hour. We go hungry and thirsty. We're in rags. We've been brutally treated. We're homeless. We work hard with our own hands. There's nothing wrong with that in itself. It's just this was absolutely, you know, exhausting work in addition to all the other stuff that they had to do. We're cursed when you're blessed. We're persecuted and you endure. We're slandered. When we're slandered, we answer kindly. We have become, here it is. You might have heard this phrase before. It comes directly from the Bible. We have become the scum of the earth, the garbage of the world right up to this point. So do you want to be a winner in 2012? Well, guess what? You just need to be a fool. You need to see how weak you are. You need to understand that you might be dishonored and that, you know, relationally or in your prestige or whatever, for Americans, you might not have, you might kind of have a famine there. You might be brutally treated. You know, you might lose a job out of for integrity's sake, persecuted, slandered. And in the eyes of a lot of people, especially the beautiful people, especially the popular culture, especially the talk show people, especially all the, you know, the movie star types and whatever, when you stand up for what's really right and you're out of sync with that, you might be considered the scum of the earth. Do you want to be a winner? Really? What do you think of that list? That's what he's saying, though. Jesus addressed what a winner is. Let me just give you this one last thing to kind of wrap this up. Because his disciples were caught up in prestige and power. And it says, you know, Jesus, the clock's ticking here. And you need to manifest yourself as the leader. You need to be the winner. You need to conquer our country and, you know, establish Israel back with its original borders and do all this stuff. And you're not doing any of that. And he wanted Jesus to be this powerful control leader and just kick everyone's agendas. And Jesus called them to himself. Jesus called them. It says in Matthew 20:25, Jesus called them to himself and said, now you know what the rulers of the Gentiles, they lorded over them. That is, you know, it's definitely a slave economy. And the royalty of people in power could just, at a whim, have people arrested. They could have them whipped. It was crystal clear. And in our culture today, there are real people with power. And guess who they are? They are us. If every one of you could go to Lagos, Nigeria with me, guess what? You would be a person of power big time. You would be. But he said this, you know, the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them, those who are great exercise authority over them. Verse 26, yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, hint, hint, like all of you here do, is what he's saying, and you're mad at each other for jockeying for position. It's like there's going to be a startup. And who's going to get the most stock in this new startup that's going to really hit a home run? That's what's going on. Let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And so basically what Jesus is saying is this. Winners don't lord it over other people, but they live a life by example. Winners are not about power and position, prestige, but they are about serving. How do you serve others? How you serve it at New Life even? You know, we're coming to a spectacular year, you guys. And if you're just coming and just kind of sitting here, you know, what's that all about? What does that say to your children and your grandchildren? Your resources. What does that say to your family around you? You know, about being a real follower? Because really the greatest thing in how volatile our times are, the greatest thing you can give your kids or anything else is an anchor in Jesus Christ, by far. The family around you, the greatest thing you give them, and you can only do that by living it. We are winners, not by being first, Jesus also says, but by being last. And that doesn't mean grovel. It doesn't mean throw the game. It doesn't mean you can't have ambitions. It doesn't mean you can't set goals. It doesn't mean any of that. It means as far as you are preferred, you will allow someone to move ahead in honor of Christ. So let me close with this, with just some phrases that are out there that are common phrases. You know, life is difficult. Have you ever heard that phrase? You hear stuff like that all the time. Life is difficult. Let me say what the Bible says. All flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man is a flower of grass. The grass withers and the flowers fall away. But the word of the Lord endures forever. Now, what I want to do is help you remember some of this stuff, okay? So I want you to remember. Oh, the third one there, if you don't have it, is see. Number three, right? It says say, but I want the word see, if you didn't get that on the screen there, okay? So, all right. So we'll get that changed for you. All right, I want you to do this. We're not receiving our offering right now. I want you to get this out, okay? Do any of you have things like this? What is this called? Okay, wallet. All right, and theoretically, what should be in wallet? Good things, right? But theoretically, all right. But the wallet here is the whole idea. It symbolizes tons of things. You know, I do have a couple of credit cards in here. I have I actually have a health insurance card in here. It's Kaiser. And, you know, you have driver's license. And all this represents things we need to kind of function in life. But you know what? It's all temporary. Unless you have a family picture or something. But it's all temporary. And so every time you pull this out, let this be a memory reminder for you of just about the temporariness of life. It doesn't mean it's not valid for now and that there aren't things now. But we can live for this. And this is temporary, okay? And then there's another one here, too. See, I've been these memory tool things. But what about this? Begin with the end in mind. Have you ever heard that phrase? Begin with the end in mind, okay? Well, let's get morbid here. And I'm looking at Hebrews 12 about finishing the race. We talked about that story at the beginning. That, you know, if you're on your deathbed, you know, the end in mind, do you hear someone on the deathbed saying, would you please bring me a new iPad? You know? Or, you know, I'd like to have a new Mac right now. You know, that new upgrade with Lion's OS, you know. And they don't. They want their family and whatever around them. And what I thought there, how many of you have something like this? You know, I don't mean an iPhone. I just mean any kind of a smartphone or a phone. Almost all phones have gadgetry on them now. Do they not? And you're able to see, have pictures on there and contacts on there and whatever. And I guess use this as a memory tool. Whenever you see this, that God has blessed you with a lot of things, a lot of friends, a lot of family members, a lot of people to stay in contact with and to value in your life. Does that make sense to you? So the wallet, temporary, this, those things that are so incredibly important to us. And hold nothing back. Hold nothing back. Have you heard that phrase? Just hold nothing back. You know, leave it all there. Matthew 6:33, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Now, do you all have these? Okay. Now, this represents all kinds of stuff, doesn't it? I mean, I have a house key on there, I have a key to the warehouse, I have a car key, things like this. And what we need to do at the beginning of the year right now is just use this as a symbol. Whenever we get this out, say, God, all of this belongs to you. This all belongs to you. It isn't mine. It all belongs to you. And let this be a memory tool for you. And then the last one is how to learn how to win. Learn how to win. You got to learn how to win in life. Have you heard that? Now, I'm looking around the room, and there's a mixed bag here. So I have two different memory tools. And the one is glasses. I see a lot of people with glasses and a lot of people with contacts because you're kind of squinting at me. And it's just the idea of how you see other people. You need to get God's focus on how you really see other people and how God looks at the heart. But if that doesn't work for you, I came up with one last one. Paper towels. Have you ever used these? Paper towels? And I close with this. Do you know how Jesus modeled leadership when they came up with all these questions? Who's going to be top leader? Who's going to be your number one? Who's going to be your number two? Jesus took on the role of a slave. We don't even understand that in our culture today. and he washed gnarly, muddy, crappy, dusty feet. Because that's what they did in their custom when they came into a home. They usually had the lowest slave wash everyone's feet while they were sitting there talking with each other. This is like an invisible person. Could you imagine that? And Jesus took on the role and washed the feet of all of his disciples. And so whenever you use a paper towel, just let it be a reminder. If you want to be a winner this year, you need to be like Jesus. And if you want to be like Jesus, it's not going to be about power. Look, if you're going to be a servant, it's going to be being about forgiving and not keeping a score and not keeping a record. And so whenever you see a towel, let that be a reminder. I'm going to serve you, Jesus. I let them off the hook. I forgive them. See, does that make sense to you all? Let's pray.